All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Thank you for listening. I'm a little strung out. I'm a little tired. I'm a little jacked up on coffee and nicotine lozenges right now. We've been shooting the new show, the Glow Show, the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. And the flashbacks continue. Emotions within me keep percolating to the surface. I don't know what's going on, but I'll have to look at it as a plus. Like, I have to play a bit of an asshole, and when I'm a bit of an asshole and I'm a bit of a bully on the show, I feel the emotions that are counter to that going on inside of me right after I do it. Like, right after I do a mean thing, I feel sad. I feel almost teary, and I have to go apologize to the actress. That was yesterday. I apologized to Alison Brie. She's in character. I'm in character. But right after I get out of the character, I got to go check in, make sure everything's okay, because that's who I am. I'm apparently a male menopausal 53-year-old man. I'm okay with it. I can only assume that it's a good thing. Today on the show, Margo Price, the amazing, I'm going to say country music artist, though she is not a mainstream country music artist. Her record is, her solo record is on Third Man Records, Midwest Farmer's Daughter. She had a couple of records I just got with her other band called Buffalo Clover was the name of her other band that I learned about during the conversation you will hear momentarily. And those records are fucking great. I love her voice. I love her songwriting. I don't love all country music, obviously, but I like a lot of it. I kind of grew up with it. I mean, I grew up in New Mexico. It was certainly around. There were definitely cowboys around. There was definitely country music around. The state fair, I remember growing up, and every year it would be country music people: Roy Clark, Buck Owens, Waylon, Willie, Chris, George, Dottie. I believe that they all were there at some point at the Albuquerque State Fair, but it wasn't really my bag. Though I do have some cowboy in me, and I think some of you know that. I have a strange, eclectic background. Listener emails, Kamasi, subject line: Dear Mark, thank you for having Kamasi Washington on your show. I listened to your show, which led me to listen to the Epic, which led me to Google his tour dates, which led me to sitting in the third row at a show last night. Loved it. I loved it. Thank you, Stephanie. You're welcome, Stephanie. My menstrual cycle. And Mark, hey, want to hear something funny? I can tell when I'm about to start my period sometimes when I listen to your show. It's when you say Boomer lives at the end. If I get sad and sometimes even tear up, then I know it's coming soon and it's pissed. Too much? Oh, well, you are my spirit animal, Lindsay M. You're welcome. I'm glad I can help you know when your period is coming. That's a service I didn't know I provided for anybody, but I appreciate knowing that. So, country music. Margo Price, I don't know, man. It's just something about her voice, something about the production and the playing that, like, when I put that record on from Third Man, that first one, or her solo record, Midwest Farmer's Daughter, it's just one of those things where you put a record on and you're like, this is the real shit. And I've listened to it so many times. And it was one of these guests that I have here sometimes where I'm just like in awe and happy that we're talking. And I kept thinking about what I was going to talk to her, how do you start a conversation? And then I started thinking about when I was very young, when my family moved from Alaska to Albuquerque, I lived in the basement with my brother. It was a basement of a house in Albuquerque. It was like 1972, probably 1973. My mom put shag carpeting in there, painted the cabinets. There was wood paneling. They let me have some pretty devious posters, really, for a 10-year-old. I had the black light sexual positions poster. I don't know why they let me have it. They were not great parents, but they were permissive, so that was cool. I had Easy Rider. I had Dennis Hopper on the chopper flipping the bird. I had that. What else did I have down there? Yeah. And it was years later, and there were two rooms down there. There was like another room that had linoleum floor that we didn't use much. It didn't really happen. I used to, you know, fuck around with my chemistry set in that room. But a couple of years after we were living there, my mother's cousin Jay found there was all these drugs up in the lights that the people from the who'd lived there before had stashed up there. I didn't know about drugs, but and I didn't know about sexual positions, and I didn't really understand Easy Rider. But I was 10, and that was what was sinking in. I mean, this was 1972. This is what pop culture was sending, you know, the messages to my brain with. I mean, the first records I bought, a Mountain record. I had Jethro Tull's Aqualung. I had the Beatles' second album. But most importantly, there was this box of cassettes. My parents had this old Iowa cassette player that had detachable speakers, and I inherited it somehow, and it was downstairs. And they had a box of cassettes, and in that box of cassettes was Bobby Gentry's Ode to Billy Joe and Johnny Cash live at San Quentin. And that was the Bobby Gentry record was definitely the Ode to Billy Joe record. So I had these two cassettes, and I remember playing compulsively A Boy Named Sue, Folsom City Blues, and Ode to Billy Joe. And that, I believe, was my first real connection with country music. And those were pretty good ones for a 9-year-old who just had a box of cassettes, because there was Jerry Vale's greatest hits in there. I didn't get involved with that. Maybe I listened to God Didn't Make Little Green Apples and It Don't Rain in Indianapolis in the Summertime. I believe that was on there. I thought it was catchy. Also in that box was Cosmos Factory. So Bobby Gentry, Ode to Billy Joe, Johnny Cash live at San Quentin, and Creedence Clearwater's Cosmos Factory, which had Up Around the Bend, which has one of the most searing, beautiful guitar pieces. Like that, those three records. So that's at the core of who I am and my understanding of country music. And so I decided that Bobby Gentry, and I've got a few Bobby Gentry albums now on vinyl, I for some reason wanted to talk to Margo Price about Bobby Gentry, and that turned out not to be a bad idea. Also, I remember watching the end of the Porter Wagoner show before Walt Disney, before Disney, on Sunday nights, I believe, Porter Wagoner show. I remember watching Hee Haw. I remember, and not that these are like make any difference, but I'm just trying to figure out when it started to integrate into my brain. Obviously, a lot of the music I like now is country and country related, but it was around, you know. My father, when he had A Secret Life, used to, you know, go Western dancing, we found out later, at the Caravan in Albuquerque. It was a big, yeah, there was a lot. I remember the square dancing thing. That was happening. But I guess I should talk a little bit more about when I had a horse. It wasn't my horse. It was assigned to me. And I went to several camps when I was a kid. It wasn't so much that my parents wanted me to do exciting things. Maybe they did, but I think they wanted me out of the house. And over the course of my childhood, I went to a tennis camp. I went on a teen tour, which is a sort of strange Jewish expedition of mostly teenagers from the five towns in Long Island, and I somehow ended up amongst them. Barren teen tours. So yeah, I went on a teen tour. I went to a tennis camp, and I went to, I eventually went to a music and arts camp, which was the best camp for me. But the first camp I went to was Brush Ranch in Pecos, New Mexico, where we had to have our own Stetson hat, and we had to show up with fishing rods, and we had to be willing to shoot guns, and we had to have jeans, certain Levi's. We needed Levi's, had to put your name and everything. But I think the most telling thing was the cowboy hat. We needed cowboy boots. Gil, this weird cowboy that was in charge of the horses, he taught us how to fold our hat so it pointed down the top and bent down, and it looked cool. It looked cool. We had to bend up those fucking Stetsons. I learned how to, some people were asking me because I passively said I know how to tie flies. Part of fly fishing was part of the Brush Ranch experience. I did some, learned how to tie flies. You had your little vise, and you had your little hook, and then you had your little feathers and stuff, and we tied some flies. They were clunky, but, you know, fish doesn't fucking know, really. But I learned how it's done, and it was interesting and exciting. It was not something I pursued for a life. Learned how to shoot shotguns and also load shotgun shells. think I owe an apology to this dorky, annoying douchebag from Texas named Jeff, who me and a couple other of the guys, when we were loading shotgun shells, put a double load of powder and a very little shot into one of Jeff's shells, just see him get knocked on his ass by the shotgun. He was okay. It was funny, but I feel bad about it now, and this might be part of the reason that I'm crying occasionally. So sorry, Jeff. I hope you're okay. It was very funny, though. So yeah, in a pinch, if you gave me the machine, I could load a shotgun shell. I believe you put the powder in, and then the wad, and then the shot, and then you seal that fucker. So we shot some skeet, shot some 22s, didn't shoot any animals. Felt a couple of vaginas up there at night. And then she went on to be with some other dude who was a friend of mine at camp. That was not good. Heartbreaking. But the cowboy element, so yeah, I had the hat. Anyway, has nothing to do with country music. I just wanted to share my bona fides, my bona fides of having some country past. And, you know, and I wore the boots for a long time, though they shifted from cowboy boots to rock and roll boots, man. So as a grown man, I've grown to appreciate country music. It was always around. And now I like it even more. I had Sturgill Simpson on this show. And now I believe this is, if there is somebody equally as important in modern country music as Sturgill seems to be, if not even a little more important on some level to me, only because I'm enamored and amazed by her singing and songwriting, it's Margo Price. You can get Margo's debut album, Midwest Farmer's Daughter. It's on Third Man Records. She does play a song at the end. She's amazing. I'm going to talk to her right now. Me and Margo Price. That's how you record your ideas when you're at home? You just get the tape rolling?
Well, we used to, but we haven't redone a studio. I mean, we just sold everything we had. We had like a nice console and microphones. This was like maybe 2 years ago.
You and your husband?
Yeah.
What's his name?
Me and my old man, Jeremy Ivey.
And he's in the band.
Well, he was. And then,
oh my God, you're kicking your husband out of the band?
He dislocated his finger right before SNL. Which was
really?
A bummer.
So
yeah.
Who stepped in?
This guy named Kevin Black. He played with Sturgill Simpson for a while.
I talked to Sturgill Simpson.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah, he's, I know Stu.
Stu?
Yep.
Is that what you call him?
Stu.
Well, now I listen to, I like you.
Hey, thanks. I like you too. I don't like many people.
Is that true?
It is.
But like, I don't know how I got the record. It might have come in a package, and I had it for a while, and I didn't, like, you know, I didn't fully take it in, yeah. And then I put it on again a little while ago, and it was like, holy shit, she's time traveling. She's a time traveling wizard.
Born in the wrong age, I think.
Well, sometimes. I don't know. I guess, but I mean, there's a purity to it that type of music should transcend time.
Yeah, hopefully,
right?
Hopefully, you know, good music is.
And there's sadness. You have the built-in sadness.
Yeah, the eternal sadness.
You tap into the eternal. See, not everyone has it though.
Yeah,
there's a lot of fakers.
Yeah,
a lot of phony sad people.
The whiny emo.
Something. There's just people that use the old styles but don't have the real, the eternal pain.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people out there that, you know, do the throwback traditional stuff, but they're also scared of like throwing a, you know, phaser in there or,
yeah,
you know, like, yeah, you can't just do the old timey music and expect people to think
that,
wow, this is great, you know,
right?
Because you're just regurgitating
shit
that's already been done.
Right. You can't use it as a gimmick.
Right. Yeah.
And that's, I felt that. And I felt that with Sturgill too, to a degree, you know, that there was a respect for the sound, for the structure of those type of songs, but also for the production of, you know, what was, I think most people think, real country.
Yeah. And being able to take a risk, you know.
Yeah.
Really not.
What do you
not
see the
afraid
risk as being to do that, to produce like that?
Yeah. I mean, the opening track on the album, Hands of Time.
Oh, it's sad.
Yeah, it's a sad one. It's
gets me every time. It's one of those, that gets me every time song.
Yeah, I don't play that every night either because it's sometimes audiences are just not.
Really?
You know.
What are they, kids? Are you looking at kids usually?
No, I mean, it's, you know, it just has to be the right vibe. If people are like too drunk or something.
Oh, you don't want to be.
It's like, I don't want to sing that if it's a really loud.
So you need to get to a place in your own heart and in that moment to sing that.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be interrupted by someone going, ow!
Exactly. I love you! You know, it's like...
Well, that's good to hear that you can't autopilot through.
You can't do it. Some nights you feel it and some nights you don't. But with that song in the production, when I was writing it, I actually wrote it on piano, but my husband was playing bass on the record and my drummer, Dylan Napier, Dylan put a what he calls a Wu-Tang drum beat on the beginning of that.
Yeah.
First, I was kind of unsure of it. And then the more I listened to it, I realized that it, you know, kind of took the song somewhere else. And it wasn't just, you know, another like folky.
Right. Yeah. Thing, I don't know if I now I'm going to have to listen to for the boom, Wu-Tang.
Boom, boom, boom.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah. It's just got a little funky groove in there.
But that's happened. Like, I mean, that's like, you know. Like, I keep thinking when I was a kid, I had like these, this box of cassettes that I inherited from my parents. And one of them was Bobby Gentry.
Yes.
Ode to Billy Joe.
So good.
That album.
So good.
And that, like, that song has a, like, a, there's has, a funk yeah, element
yeah,
to it.
Yeah. She's got so much good stuff. Lordy Made a Woman Out of Me. I mean, she just did it differently. You
yeah.
know?
And, right.
And it, that
she was a little groovier.
Yeah. And the Mississippi song, Mississippi Delta.
Yeah, yeah.
So good. So brilliant.
Yeah, and I think having seen that movie when I was a little kid and what they did to that song. And did you ever see the movie?
No.
It's brutal. It's what's the kid's name? Bobby. What's that actor's name?
It's just
name?
Based off the whole song? Kinda?
It's a little bit. There's, I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, no, it is, but I don't know that all of it's in there because there's Billy Joel McAllister in the movie gets sort of like, you know, gang raped by a bunch of hillbillies.
Whoa. That's heavy.
That's not in the song. This yeah. guy played by, I'm forgetting his name.
Well, but it's like you kind of never know why she, you know, why no, he.
Right. Well, they just speculated, I guess.
Yeah.
Or maybe they wrote the movie and decided, now I got to know the guy's name.
I know.
Name.
What I love about that song too is in the verses she's just talking about like sitting around the dinner table, you know, chewing the food, and it's so mundane. It captures like the mundane moments of being around the family table, and I feel like Bob Dylan took inspiration from that song. He did this really bizarre tune called Clothesline Hanging Saga.
Uh-huh.
It was during Basement Tapes. It was the same thing. It's just talking about his mother being outside and some guy passing by, and they talk politics, and then you know.
And you think he was listening?
I feel like that was inspired by.
Well,
by
he's
that
definitely
song.
He's definitely a sponge. There's no.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of his best attributes, I think, or his worst. It's probably the
what
best.
Do you say
and
amateurs
the worst.
Borrow professional steel.
Dylan just becomes.
Yeah, he just becomes. He
absorbs metamorphs. And manifests.
Yeah.
So, I'm glad that we talked about Bobby because, like, I guess I sensed something. About like, and I didn't think it would come through that song, but there is a funk kind of element to her.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely for you.
And she produced
chances.
A lot of her own shit too. Like she put out a lot of her own records.
That's her picking the guitar too on there. She was, you know, good.
Did you ever? Is she around?
You know, it was just her birthday.
She's 72, June 27th. Right.
If you're out there, Bobby, I love you.
Isn't that interesting though?
Yeah.
That like this, like a very prominent sort of artist. And no one really knows, because usually with country people, they keep going forever.
Exactly. You can't kill us. Yeah. We don't kill ourselves.
Exactly. A mixture of both.
Yeah.
But I wonder where she lives.
Reach out to her.
Like there's part of, like, I don't know that I listened to country when I was a kid, except for that Bobby Gentry record. And another one of those cassettes was Johnny Cash Live at San Quentin.
Yeah.
So I had those two when I was like really young, just because they were in a box of cassettes.
Exactly.
But in Albuquerque, like, cause we had rodeo and we had the state fair and it was always country acts coming through.
Yeah.
But so it was always there in the background, but it was
you were
not,
like, I don't.
No, it was just my parents weren't into it. And when I was a kid, I'm 52. So what I was listening, I listened to Skynyrd.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when I was in junior high, it's like Skynyrd's good.
Yeah.
It's just what I grew up with. Great classic townie, yeah. You know, rock.
Well, oddly enough, I grew up listening to a lot of rap. I mean.
Well, how old are you? 20, like 20 years younger than me. What are you, 30 something?
33. Yeah.
So yeah, so you're that was popular music when you were like in junior high and shit.
Yeah.
And that was your thing?
I mean, Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, it's good stuff.
But where'd you grow up? Let's get into the anatomy of that heartbreaking song. Because when, like, even my girlfriend was like, this really happened to her? And I'm like, yeah, I think it all happened to her.
Couldn't make it up if I tried. I grew up tiny little town, like 3,600 people. And it was just 3.5 hours west of Chicago. So it was on the Mississippi bordering
in Illinois.
Illinois. It was right by Iowa, but we were on the Illinois side.
Yeah.
And my folks lived outside of the town. They lived north of the town. It was called Aledo.
Yeah.
And but we lived just about a mile from this other town that was called Hamlet, and the sign is still there. It says Hamlet, population 34.
Really? Did you take a picture of it?
Not a lot of culture. I do have a photo of it somewhere.
That seems like you should use it somewhere.
Yeah, it's you know, there's
no town there anymore?
It's still a town, but it's just a church and some houses.
Oh, so there was no like 3-store main street?
Yeah. I mean, my town had one stoplight, Aledo did, and they had a Hardee's and a Walmart. And you know.
Oh really?
And then Walmart happened, that was a huge deal. And that was kind of when
probably employed half the town.
Yeah. It did. Well, and they needed it too, because that was when the farming crisis happened,
right.
And you know, my family, my grandfather and all his brothers and all their sons, they all lost the farm, and it was kind of right around the time that Walmart came in and all, you know,
the shift,
the crooked bankers and
well, what happened? What did they farm?
They farmed mostly corn and soybeans and cattle, a little bit of cattle, but
so you grew up with that for generations. Like that was your family.
That was the
And where'd they all come from originally? What's the roots? Do you know?
I mean, like Irish, Sherman.
Oh, yeah.
So just I'm a mutt of a lot of different things, but and they're my grandmother still lives in the town. My folks still live in the town.
In Aledo?
In Aledo.
Yeah.
I think they're gonna put up a sign for me when you go in.
Maybe a street.
Yeah, who knows?
Are they happy for you?
Yeah, they're happy for me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Were they always?
My mom was always hopeful. She's always real hopeful. Kept a positive attitude. God bless her. And
so, but like, what's going on in a town like 3,000 some odd? That's as many people that were in my high school.
Yeah.
And I didn't come from a big town, but that's like a real small town. So y'all kind of knew each other. Y'all went to all the grades together. Y'all watched each other get fucked up on drugs and die and go to jail.
Exactly.
And maybe get out.
Yep,
that
suicides
kind of
and boredom does terrible things to people.
Uh-huh.
Because there just wasn't any culture. There was like a little movie theater in town, but they only showed one movie and it would run for like 2 weeks.
Like a mainstream movie?
Yeah, like I don't even know.
Right.
I saw Mr. Holland's Opus there. And that was
there you go.
Memory.
Little Richard Dreyfuss. That might have had a profound impact.
I mean, that was kind of the only thing you could do. But then otherwise, you just would drive around on the back roads and drink beer.
Yeah.
And smoke pot.
And park.
You know, yeah.
And then someone would play the music through their car speakers.
Exactly. Exactly. We'd cruise the loop in the main town, and then the cops would like pull you over and say you'd made too many loops and you had to.
And you knew the cop.
You knew the cop. People sat at home listening to their police scanner when, you know,
right,
so everyone
right,
knew
right.
someone was getting in trouble.
Right.
It would be in the paper. So-and-so was arrested with 2 grams of marijuana and some paraphernalia. It was always.
And everyone knew who it was.
Yeah.
Whose kid it was.
Then you'd be, labeled the.
Pothead.
The outcast.
Problem.
Yeah.
Were you an outcast?
I would go kind of back and forth.
You dated some outcasts?
Yeah, I sure did. I dated a vandal for 6 years.
When you were in high school?
When I was in high school, yeah. He's a sweet guy.
Sweet vandal?
Sweet vandal.
Where's that song?
That's a good one. We've got to get out my notebook here.
Sweet vandal.
So, yeah, it was.
But how much of a vandal could you be? How far was the next town? I mean, you had to rob people you knew.
Yeah, you had to really be careful. I remember there was a party that was thrown outside of my parents' house, and it didn't get busted, but yeah. There were photos of the party, and people had beers in their hands, and they all got taken to court
for drinking outside
and charged with the photos, saying, "Well, you had a beer in your hand, and you're 16, so you're getting underage drinking ticket." Yes.
So this was, but your parents weren't home, or it was somewhere
near? Well, I didn't get a go. My mom kept a pretty short leash on me when uh-huh. she could.
Oh, so it was near your parents'
house? It was right near my folks' house. All my friends got busted. Another time there was a party that...
From the picture?
From the picture.
How'd they get the picture?
How did they
get the picture?
That can't be legal.
No, but how did they get it?
I don't know. I mean, there was, you know, blackmail, shit like that would happen. It was just a corrupt little town in ways, you know?
So wait, so some cop's kid took a picture...
And then it got...
And the town needed money that bad that they had to fine a bunch of 16-year-olds
apparently.
For drinking beer?
I mean, it's the kind of town where, you know, there was a couple people high up and they were given tax breaks right. to their relatives to start businesses. And then all of a sudden, everybody wondered where the money went. And, of course, they found out.
It all funneled through the relatives?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, they embezzled
it? The same guy that was doing that for his relatives, he was the crooked banker who kind of...
Took the farm?
Fucked things over for the farm, so... You know, hopefully he will get his karma will come back to him, and yeah.
So when you were in high school, like, you didn't get into so much trouble that it destroyed your life then?
No, I waited until I got to college because, like I said, my parents kept a pretty tight leash, and then, you know, I think with a lot of Americans, you all of a sudden have this newfound freedom, and then you start binge drinking. And
so you were a boozer,
making a lot of bad decisions. Yeah.
When did you start playing, though? What were your sort of things when you were in high school, aside from driving around drinking beer, smoking weed with vandals?
Yeah,
listening to rap music.
Listening to my rap music. I picked up a guitar, I think, when I was 12, and I'd played piano prior, but I didn't like my piano teacher, so none of that really stuck.
But you still write on piano sometimes?
Yeah, I do. I wrote Hands of Time on piano.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it was just, I would cruise around in the car and have my guitar with me, and I was
what were
one
you
of
singing?
The only ones. Oh,
come on. Go ahead.
I'll, to save myself, I will preface that, you know, I love Tom Petty and the Statler Brothers, but I did like Jewel a lot when she first came out, and I liked her album Pieces of You because it was just really different than everything else.
You don't have to feel bad for that.
Jewel was great. That first album was
earnest.
Amazing. She
spoke her heart.
She did. Played. Yeah, she had a broken nose. She didn't care about getting fixed. I feel you, Jewel.
And you were exactly her market. Just sad, isolated teenage girls in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
Emotionally and geographically.
Probably reached me like 2-3 years later after it reached the rest of the world.
Oh, really?
Like everything in the Midwest, fashion.
But wasn't she like from Alaska?
Yeah.
Like up
Hell
there.
Of a yodeler too.
I remember like I liked her. I think she had the unfortunate fate of people getting tired of her for some reason.
Yeah.
Some people just, I don't know what it is culturally, where people just sort of like, bleh.
Yeah, I mean, she maybe didn't change with the times.
Maybe.
I don't know. I was a little disappointed in her book of poems, but that's...
It's hard, man. They're hard
to sell. Poems are hard to sell, yeah. I'm thinking about putting out a book of poems myself.
Maybe
I better wait on that. Make sure they're good.
After the third record, do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you write poems?
I do, yeah.
Yeah?
I wrote a really sad 6-page poem the other day. I'll share it with you when we're done here.
Really?
It's just about the decline of humanity and...
Oh.
It's really uplifting.
Yeah. Is it free verse or rhymed or?
Yeah, it's mostly just free verse.
Just went for it.
Just word vomit.
Well, how do you like? What differentiates? Obviously, structurally, a song is different than a poem. But do you start without it necessarily being a song when you write?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I'll just be writing, and then if it's a good enough poem, I'll turn it into a song.
Right.
But other times, it's just. There's nothing that can be done with it, and it's just going to be a bunch of crap on a page.
But it feels better.
Yeah.
Once it's out of you, it's
exactly.
out of you.
Exactly. It's such a purging
Yeah, I scribble shit all the time.
Yeah,
when I'm writing comedy ideas, it's never a joke. It's always an idea. It's always on a post-it.
Yep.
It's always while I'm driving.
How do you keep track of all that stuff? Then
I'm not good. No, because like no matter how many times I transcribe it, my writing still sucks. So I can't even trust my own interpretation of me.
What it was?
Yeah, like just
doctor's handwriting.
Yeah, it becomes very challenging. Sometimes I'll type it up, but there's something about, you know, I've sat down and done it. You know, transcribe stuff and written stuff out. And then, like, I lose interest in it. Like, I know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, once it's written down and fully, I'm like, I'm not writing songs. I'd like to write a song.
Write a song.
Really? How do we just do it?
Yeah. We'll take some stuff after we get down at the end here.
What was the Vandal song?
Sweet Vandal.
Sweet Vandal.
Yeah. That's good.
I hope it becomes, I'd like to be part of that.
All right. I'll give you 10% co-write.
I don't want any money.
I just want to slash Maron.
Mark Maron, in the credits, Mark Maron suggested the title.
I like that.
During our conversation.
That's good.
what was that guy up to at the Vandal?
I don't know. He went on this tear of the town one night where he just destroyed a bunch of shit. I can't remember if he was like egging cars and he like ripped down somebody's basketball court.
Wow, this is the saddest outlaw song. It's the most immature outlaw.
He smashed like 200 pumpkins from the guy who like makes pumpkins and sells them during Halloween.
Oh, this
and
is
I
not...
like knew about it, and then the cops were questioning me.
About
your
the
boyfriend
pumpkin?
Smashed the pumpkins out of Duncan's pumpkins.
Come on. It's already rhyming.
It's good. We got material.
But he's not going to really become some sort of outlaw tragic hero with the crimes that you've...
Well, there were probably more bad things he did.
I think it's sort of a funny take on like a song about like an outlaw, but it's really all these childish things.
Yeah.
To write like a classic kind of outlaw ballad, but it's just about a guy who egged some shit and smashed some pumpkins.
Yeah, not really that bad of a guy.
and he didn't end up in jail. He just ended up like an insurance salman or something. Like
he totally is just...
He's just a guy?
Two kids now, nice house, just a regular guy.
That'd be the funniest outlaw ballad in the world. Like, what happened to that guy?
He actually straightened out much quicker than I did. You know, I had to take the long way around.
Oh, so that's good. You didn't end up with a real outlaw.
Yeah.
You could have, I guess. Maybe there just wasn't any around.
Yeah, there's slim pickings, you know, and you got 77 people in your graduating class.
And you knew all of them.
You knew all of them.
Everyone knew and everyone lost their virginity.
Business. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And when they didn't and someone said they did, all that gossip.
Yep.
So when you write songs, do you ever like, because I've been listening to, like I just recently transitioned into actually listening to songs, the words.
Yeah.
Like I was always like a riff guy, melody guy. Like
totally.
And choruses somewhat, you know. And
don't bore us, get to the chorus.
whose advice is that?
Maybe Tom Petty's. It came off that Tom Petty documentary. You know, it's really hard to find someone that doesn't like Tom Petty.
But some people don't
give
him the credit that he deserves.
Yeah, I mean,
everyone likes him, but then if you really like, he wrote so many fucking songs.
He did.
And you know them all.
Yeah.
And they're great.
They're so memorable, but just not contrived.
Yep.
I remember the first time I heard Last Dance with Mary Jane. I was so young. I didn't know what it meant, but I just thought it was the coolest fucking song I'd ever heard.
Yeah.
And it was a nice escape from the, you know, from the town.
Yeah, he wrote a couple of good country songs too. He wrote that Mystery Man on the first record, which is beautiful.
Have you watched that documentary?
No.
You got to check it out.
It's like a day long, right?
Yeah. I didn't want it to end though. It was like 2-3 in the morning and my husband was like, we got to go to sleep. No, keep watching.
But do you ever write like a chorus? Does a chorus come to your head first? Do you like hooks like that?
Sometimes. Actually, just got this this custom guitar from Fender that they put my name down the neck in like a pearl inlay.
Really?
It's the coolest thing I'd ever seen. It's so heavy.
Oh.
It's a Telecaster and I'm used to playing like lightweight guitar, but...
It's a weighty Telecaster.
Yeah.
So they must have made it out of the big,
it's
the
heavy rosewood. Yeah. And so I've been writing licks on that. I feel like it's changed, you know, kind of changed the way I'm
playing some lead.
Yeah. Playing some lead, trying to work at it, you know,
because
I feel like you hit a level on guitar and then you're like, all right, just
no, I've been sitting at it and I don't play professionally. So, like, you know, I've been...
You got licks, man.
I got licks.
You got licks.
I can play... Yeah, I do.
You got more licks than me.
I know, but, like, but you got to do it every night. Like, I'm always amazed when I have musicians in here and, like, you know, we sit there and they'll play a song and they'll just nail it. And I'm like, what the fuck? And then you realize, like, oh, that's their job.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
Well, I, like, hire people to play my licks and then I just...
No, but you guys, when you sit down and play a song, you know, you've got a lot of hours in it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have those muscles of performing a whole night on stage or playing with other people. It's very easy to sit in here
and
noodle.
Noodle, yeah. That's one of my favorite phrases. My
noodling?
Yeah. I had this jazz drummer who was like real meticulous guy.
Who was in the studio with you?
No, we were just on the road and we were like setting up. We were actually just playing in a parking lot. Dockweiler Beach.
Uh-huh. I don't know where that is.
It's in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah?
It was the first time I was ever here and we were living in a 1986 Winnebago. And
here?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. We got to get back to the story.
Yeah.
We stopped before we even went to college. And now we're at Winnebago.
Now we're at the Winnebago. Yeah, living like a dirty hippie. We were in this parking lot and because we didn't have that many great shows. And so we thought, we'll just set up and play here for the people at the trailer park.
Yeah.
And my bass player was like, you know, warming up a little bit. And the drummer said, if we could actually, could we keep the noodling to a minimum? So we say that on stage a lot. Keep noodling.
The control freak guy.
Yeah.
So you graduated high school. You're playing a little guitar, playing some Jewel, writing some poetry, hanging out with Pumpkin Smashers.
You're getting out all these things no one's ever heard.
Parents had you on a short leash, but you found time to drive around and drink beer and listen to rap music.
Yep.
But so what do you... When you go to college, what are you going to... Do you just want to get out or you got a plan?
Just wanted to get out. I didn't really know what I wanted to major in. My mom was like, you should be in communications and do advertising.
That vague communication.
Yeah, the vague communications thing.
What'd she do, your mom?
So she's a teacher. Well, she was a teacher. She's retired now. Mm-hmm. She taught third grade for years and
years. Oh, that's probably a pleasant experience. They're not fucked up in third grade yet.
Yeah, the kids.
Yeah, there's not a... Your mom, not a question.
She's wonderful.
Was she a loopy teacher?
She was a little loopy. You know, she's sleep deprived. She she always said, don't be a teacher because you don't get paid enough. She would pay me to grade her papers. It'd be like, I'll give you $10 if you will grade these papers.
She knew there wasn't a big risk of plagiarism or any of that with third grade papers.
Yeah.
It was just grammar.
Could spot it.
Yeah.
And I did communications for a year and then I started playing more guitar, listening to Zeppelin. And then the next year I majored in theater and dance. And
really?
Yeah, I did.
Dance?
Dance, yeah. I had been thrown into dance when I was like 3 years old.
Ballet?
Yeah, ballet, tap, jazz, gymnastics, cheerleading.
You were a cheerleader?
American Dream.
Yeah, you were a cheerleader?
Yeah, I was.
Were you the head cheerleader?
I was. Mm. And then...
Now, see, like, that tarnishes my image. But I'll,
yeah,
I'll
get, I know. It's but hopefully dirty you secret, get, but...
Hopefully, like, you get really messed up in a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, I got blackmailed my senior year.
Blackmailed? What is this blackmailing?
This is the town, I'm telling you.
But, like, what? Like...
Well, we had taken this photo in our sports bras, like, in the cheerleading uniform, and the day of, like, our senior night or whatever, we were supposed to, you know, do, like... Have, you know, everybody give you flowers and say thanks for your service, you know. And
your service as a cheerleader.
You know.
Thank you.
Thanks for being objectified and, you know.
Out there on the front lines of high school sports. We don't know where we'd be without our
where
country
would we
owes
be?
You.
Yeah. And it was, these photos got sent to the principal and they were like, you can't do the senior night. So then there were all these ugly rumors going around. That we were all having a big orgy and we were naked in the photos. And this is the stuff that goes on in the town and people actually believed it.
Small towns love that.
Oh, you're all lesbians. And it's a photo of us in our sports bras.
Really? So it got that out of hand? It's so funny because our entire culture is driven by that garbage now. But it used to be a small town thing.
It's like one person like stole the photo out of our locker and then people started sending it around on the internet. And then it got sent to the principal. And so I left high school with just, I really wanted to get out of that town because there was just so much gossip. And
you
so
were
much shit.
A lesbian who had orgies
I mean,
with
yeah,
other cheerleaders.
I didn't even know that about myself. I go to college. I cheered for 1 year on a scholarship, and then
a scholarship for cheerleading.
Mm-hmm. It was a Big Ten school.
So you could move. You could probably, like, if you needed
to. Yeah,
could do some
flips and stuff. But and I started smoking a lot of pot and listening to Zeppelin and playing more guitar.
And that was erasing the cheerleading?
It was erased it all. I had my first, like, mushroom trip and saw the whole world in a different place, you know, like, listened to the White Album. And
oh, my God.
And was like, I don't want to be a, you know, a cheerleader or a dancer anymore.
Really?
And so then, yeah, then I...
Revolution number 9 just blasted that out of you.
Thank God it did.
That's what you got?
You know, I think when you're young and you're impressionable and, you know, you just want to, at least I did, I wanted to, you know, to please everybody and, well, I should be a dancer and I should wear red lipstick and blue eyeshadow.
So you're really, really looking at the sort of career cheerleader possibility.
No, I mean, I loved working with children. I liked to teach dance, and I did that for years.
You taught dance to kids?
After I moved to Nashville, I taught dance on the side, but I used, like, really cool music for my dance. It would be, like, a three-year-old class. I'm like, all right, now we're going to tap dance to Syd Barrett's Effervescing Elephant.
They must like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Anyways, I don't know that song. Effervescing
Elephant.
Oh, right. So they must have loved that.
But, yeah, it was, you know, and I'd use, like, Tori Amos songs, but none of the moms really understood what I was doing, probably because I was teaching in, like, Green Hills in Nashville.
What is that?
Like, just a very wealthy. Wanted me to do, like, Sugar Plum Fairy Christmas show.
Right. Oh,
and
right.
That was and definitely not what was going on.
You're opening minds. You're blowing
opening minds. Yeah.
Well, it's good that, like, you were tripping and you listened to the White Album and you what your big thing was, like, you know, there's no truth in cheerleading.
It just felt like such a hollow.
Right. And Charlie Manson took a much different message out of the White Album. That album's got a lot of range in terms of what it can do to the hallucinating mind.
It's very true. I was just glad that I just kind of changed horses midstream there and started doing the theater and dance. And
with dance, was it that, were you seeing it as, because, like, I'm curious about dance a lot of times, because when you think about, and I've never had this question answered and I don't know that you can answer it, that, you know, there, like, there's a pretty limited number of gigs for dancers.
Yeah.
So I have to assume that is something that you integrate into your general sense of creativity. Because, like, I mean, what are you really going to do as a dancer? I mean, you could become a, like, you know, the Rockettes, or, you know, there's some TV shows and you could be a background dancer for a pop act.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like it's a small pool.
Well, and my sister is a dancer still. She does, like, you know, aerial stuff hanging,
like,
from the ceiling.
She
goes around on cruise ships, and she's, like, traveled to Germany and all, you know.
So
all
your sister's
wonderful...
a professional dancer slash acrobat. Does she do the thing with the rope?
Yeah, the ropes and the silks and the hoops and
silks.
She's really talented. And
just one sister?
I have two. My other one is, like, a computer science whiz. She is big up in a company and really, you know, very different than me, but very successful. And
who's oldest?
I'm the oldest.
Yeah. And you have a little sister who's a professional dancer and acrobat of sorts on cruise ships. And you have one that's a computer whiz. So your parents must have been relatively open-minded and encouraging. It's lucky you had a teacher.
Yeah.
A loopy teacher for a mother.
Yeah.
What'd your dad do after the farm?
Oh, my dad, he went to work in a prison.
For reals?
Yeah.
That's a song. It's in the song.
It's in the song. And he...
What?
Yeah, very serious man. Man of few words, but when he talks, it's always gold. And he scared off a lot of boys, for sure.
That sounds like the opening of a song as well.
Yeah.
Man of few words, but when he talked, it was gold.
It's gold. For a while, he was a prison guard, and he drove the inmates back and forth from Chicago to other prisons.
For, like, a real prison?
Like in
Grown
The Fugitive,
prison?
You know, the guy who's, like, driving the bus or whatever.
With the guys in chains?
Yeah.
And, but it was like a grown-up prison?
Yeah, it was a serious prison.
That's a lot to see, man.
Yeah, he saw a lot. He's got some great stories. I'll have to share one or two of those with you if he doesn't get too mad at me. He worked his way up. He was the lieutenant of internal affairs, so he saw some
for the state
crazy shit go down
for the
state. Yeah,
no shit.
Yeah,
That's like, yeah, that's a, it's a whole other world.
And yeah, it's a I dark, don't think horrible that's like place. Somewhere you want to go every day by choice, you know?
No. Most people don't. They're made to go there.
Yeah, yeah. I was made to go there once and just wondered how he did it.
To prison?
Yeah, yeah. My prison song's all real in my...
Oh, really? What?
Yeah. Weekender's my prison song, and I wrote it while I was in... Well, jail. I went to
jail.
The Davidson
right,
County Jail. But I was in there with all of the real...
When did that happen?
Criminals. That was maybe 3 years ago.
Because you got fucked up?
Got fucked up. Made bad choices.
For a day or was it a bad night that got you into prison?
It was a bad night, but it was like a lot of depression that mm-hmm. led up to that. And
was that the end of it?
That was definitely the turning point. I thought
the prison.
I better get it together right now or I'm going to lose a lot of things that really matter.
Well, let's go back.
Yeah, yeah. Where were we at?
No. I it's not a problem. I'm just like I like talking to you. So you decide not to dance because you took some mushrooms and listened to the White Album. Or you decide not to be a cheerleader, but you go full on into more expressive.
Right, like modern dance.
Right, and you can do all that stuff.
Yeah, I haven't done it in a while. I mean, being a musician kind of makes you like. Lazy and uh-huh. get that musician vibe uh-huh. where your fingers work really well,
sure.
but like your arms
and
your
music doesn't necessarily call for, you know, the headpiece.
Right.
Where you?
I'm not doing the.
You're not doing mainstream country.
Yeah, I haven't went Chris Gaines yet or whatever.
It's only a matter of time, man.
It's you know it happens to everybody.
Yeah,
people
just,
keep saying, "Stay grounded,
right.
Margo."
Yeah, you hit that one groove that sells. They're going to be like, "We got some ideas for you,
yes,
girl."
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Line dancing.
Uh huh. All of it. You're going to bring it all back. It's your destiny. I won't tell.
All right.
So you start doing that. And what else changes? When does the imbibing start to... wait, now you say you're depressive?
Yeah, I've got a lot of depression.
Yeah?
Oddly enough.
When did that start showing up?
I think I've kind of always been a little manic.
Oh, manic, yeah. But not
you
bleak.
Talk a lot about like eating disorders and like the pressure of that.
Yeah,
that was definitely there with the...
cheerleading?
Yeah, and even that second year of college right before I dropped out, I was in the dance department and really diving into ballet, like, you know, 10-hour days. And they would have the scales set in there so you would weigh like 10, 15 pounds heavier than you actually did. And they would tell you if you were looking fat. So that
what college?
It was Northern Illinois University.
Uh-huh.
And I did, I mean, I, you know, I did have some good teachers there too, but yeah, all that just started to rub me the wrong way and I was just playing more and more. And then I took a trip to Nashville on my spring break and I just thought, screw it. I'm leaving the Midwest and
you're out.
I'm done.
But did you?
Who's coming with me?
Where are my ladies at?
Yep.
Or bad guys.
Yeah, where's those bad guys?
And so they came later, the bad guys?
Yeah, then I moved to Nashville, started singing in the bars.
By yourself? Jewel style?
Yeah, yeah, doing get in the stool and you sign up for the songwriter round
sure.
and you know, everybody does one song.
And you were writing songs?
I was writing songs, yeah.
All the way through or just that last year of college?
I'd been writing songs like probably even... as young as 7 or 8, but finally making full compositions
yeah.
and everything where they were more coherent at
right.
that point.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, I really got bit by the bug and
yeah.
Moved there and, you know, just floundered for years.
Doing that.
Yeah, just kind of doing that. And then I got louder and louder. I started getting into the Kinks a lot.
Great. Which records?
Oh man, Lola versus Power Man, Muswell Hillbillies.
Muswell Hillbillies.
There's
Village
just,
Green Preservation
yes,
Society.
So good, and I loved their topical approach, and they
kind
you
of
know,
funny.
Yeah, yeah, and so that we decided to start this band. My husband and I.
The
he was
same
just my
husband?
Boyfriend at the time. Yeah,
same one.
Yeah, same guy. I've been with him for 13 years, on and off. But at that time, our love came out of. Wanting to write only political songs that were like Kinks inspired.
Yeah.
But that's a really hard sell in the South. It was, you know, when the the, you know, the Iraq War was going on. I was going to like protests.
Oh yeah.
In D.C. and writing songs called like Bloodshed and Architects of War.
Oh good.
Clearing out lots of rooms because nobody wants to hear that shit. Especially in, not in Nashville.
They at were that
like,
time.
Yeah, not at that time. That was not what was hot.
I guess it's not really that hot. I mean, if you're gonna do a political song, it better be in the American direction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Love it or leave it.
Yeah, this was a questionable direction.
So, yeah, these
being
were
critical.
These
of,
ideas were out there.
Yeah, yeah. Damn hippies.
Yep, yep.
The bad
socialists.
Ones. Oh yeah, that word.
Communists.
Oh, horrible. Oh,
terrible things.
But like, what was? I mean, I have to assume at that time, if that's like 13 years ago. I mean, it's not that. It's not like it was 1975 or something. But like, I mean, Nashville had to have. There were definitely other rock bands and stuff going on.
Yeah, that was really what drew me there. Was, you know, it had a good like kind of punk scene, but I always felt like I was not punk enough for the punks. You know, couldn't rock and roll as hard as, you know, I put down the guitar, was singing with the mic, like,
oh yeah,
trying to be James Brown or
what'd you do
Jim
to your
Morrison
hair? Well, you had
something.
The moves. Were you dancing?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like crawl around on the floor, like do a back bend with the mic and scream at people and jump around. And
but you always had a singing voice.
Yeah. I still sang. I mean, I was loved Janis Joplin, you know, in that way.
So Janis was an inspiration.
Yeah, she was an inspiration. We were, you know. I was I got louder and louder. There's this Gillian Welch song. It's called "I Want to Sing That Rock and Roll." She's just talking about how she's you know singing so loud, but everybody's drowning her out with. So she wants to sing rock and roll music, and I thought, well, yeah, that's what I need to get more people to listen to me. I just need to get a big ass band, and so it grew. At first, it was just like 4-piece kind of punk band, and then I started getting really into soul music, added like a horn section.
That's Buffalo Clover?
Buffalo Clover, yeah.
I listened to that record.
Yeah, there's some moments
on
there.
It's a good record, because you're a good singer.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And like, it sounded good to me. I like the horns and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you were ahead of the curve. Sturgill just did that for his third record, and everyone thinks he's a genius.
Right, I did that. I did that like how many years ago now? Nobody heard it. And even Brittany Howard sang on that one. I thought that was going to be the shot. I had a publicist who just totally dropped the ball on that, and she didn't send it out to anybody.
Who put it out?
What label? I put it out on my own, so that probably is also why. I mean, it just didn't have much reach at all.
You know? Oh yeah, but it made the thing I liked about it was it made sense. It wasn't like, you know, it was like, wow, that's you before you became you. It was really honoring whatever you became.
Yeah, and everybody at that time, I was like, I'm making a soul rock and roll record, but when I put it out in the small amount of charts that it got put on, everybody said alternative country.
Well, that's something you guys got to fight with. I don't understand how it holds anymore.
We always just got, when we would play shows, folks would say, you sound like Dolly Parton backed by the Rolling Stones. And I'd take that.
Yeah.
But I just kind of felt maybe that something that I was doing wasn't exactly working. So then I went back and started playing my acoustic again. But
the weird thing is, so you were mad it wasn't country or it wasn't rock?
I just was mad that I was trying to make a soul record with not any acoustic instruments on it, and people were calling it country.
Oh.
Because,
right.
I mean,
but all
what country was and still kind of is at that time was maybe is more like that. I don't know.
I don't know. Like that alt country
but it was
thing.
It's still rooted, you know? It's like,
yeah, I don't,
like
I don't,
CCR or something. It's,
yes,
you know,
sure.
It's a happy medium between.
Well, I mean, country is rock. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's always been part of rock.
Like Graham Parsons, he had a great quote. It was, in all great country music, there's a little bit rock and roll.
Or the other way around, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, yeah.
And blues and country,
yeah,
you know, three chords, same progressions.
But that's all of it. That's rock.
Yeah, it is.
But the all country thing, that label, whenever it originally started happening, it's been a while. That fight has been a long, weird fight. I mean, even when... you know, Steve Earle was doing relatively mainstream.
Love Steve Earle.
Yeah, but those first couple albums, it's just fucking, you know, straight up country rock.
Totally.
And, you know, and then that label started to sort of come, that alt country thing. And even Towns Van Zandt, I don't know, gets.
Love Towns Van Zandt.
Yeah, right. But they don't get put in the canon of country artists.
It's like folk or, you know, and now what you have everybody labeling this more rooted country stuff is Americana.
Yeah, what is it? But that must just be a stronghold of that fucking paradigm of that machine, of that Nashville machine. That must be...
Right, that they want to say, well, now we need to develop a different genre for country because we can't put these people doing this kind of country and these people doing this other kind of country in the same boat, you know? And I've been doing these...
But why is that? It's because that audience is fundamentally like second or third generation away from, you know, their parents' music, which is more like what you guys are playing.
Yeah.
And now it's just this weird stadium rock version of
with the earpiece and the white teeth and the...
And some of those guys do real country. I mean, there's no doubt about it, but the production is such, and I guess the machine is such that they're not going to let you go back in time.
Yeah, yeah.
That they need to make records that cost millions of dollars to make. Just to feed the
thing. God knows why.
Who the hell fucking knows? I don't know.
Well, it's been so weird. I've been doing a couple radio tours, and I go meet these like program directors, and they're all perplexed by me. And, well, I like this, but I don't know how we're going to play this next to...
What?
You know...
these country
Keith
stations?
Toby Joe, a you know, bro country guy.
Right.
Nameless country guy.
Well, that's because they think it's going to feel like you're going back in time.
Yeah.
Like, it's really one of those issues of like, you know... I think maybe country is one of those weird things that's judged differently in that the stuff that really had integrity, you know, everyone will claim to be, you know, inspired by.
Mm-hmm.
But they think that the form of producing it, you know, like a country record used to be produced is somehow dated.
Yeah.
That must be it.
But I mean, even when I remember hearing the White Stripes for the first time, and it was like grungy, gritty rock and roll. And it was very different compared to the like bubblegum.
Right.
You
well,
know,
yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
boy band
sure,
stuff.
Sure.
But no, but like you said, it wasn't like judged like, oh, well, this is, you know,
well, I guess that's
throwback
like,
rock.
Well, I think that's because like there was never any kind of broadcast infrastructure that was equivalent to college radio for country music.
Mm-hmm.
Like you would be played on college radio because it's an open big tent.
Or open.
But there was always this
like
alternative market for rock.
Mm-hmm.
But there really wasn't one for country.
No,
I mean,
not
country
at all.
Was always country.
Yeah. And I think so many people have just written off country music. Well, I'm not going to listen to country radio because I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of those people.
Yeah.
And then I'm going into these, you know, a lot of these stations and they're just looking at me like, who the fuck? What are you?
These are country stations.
Yeah.
It's weird to me that that's the response.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't identify
it. I'm sure like some of them are playing me, but. But
like, what is Sturgill doing? Are they playing him?
Not as much as they should.
It's crazy.
You know, not as much as they should.
They just don't like you guys coming around the side.
Yeah, it's
sneaky. You guys are like.
But then everybody else, I think, is going to probably try to say, oh, I'm gonna make something genuine and rooted. And
yeah, that's what's going to
happen.
You know, right.
Yeah, I've been seeing some of that.
Oh, yeah?
And little waves, like this one kind of mainstream girl. I'm not going to say her name. But
yeah.
I mean, I just saw this thing she put up, and she said the word honest. I wanted to make something honest. She said it 5 times.
It's either that or authentic.
Authentic.
Yeah, those are the ones.
Yeah, yeah. Real deal.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, so you're playing with Buffalo Clover. You made your soul record. When's the crazy shit start?
Crazy shit starts, get pregnant. I'm married at this time, but get pregnant kind of by accident.
Now, what was the story like in the song? You said you took up with a married man. Was he married when you met him?
He was married when I met him. His ex-wife was totally crazy. She was on drugs and got pregnant with somebody else's kid and then wouldn't sign the divorce papers when he said this is over. So when I met him, he had been separated for a year. That's kind of the only thing on the album that is not, doesn't come off completely factual because I didn't.
Well, no, I mean, what are you going to say in the middle of the song?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Like, you know, for the sake of the lyric.
Yeah, just
are you
going to
go into
good.
It like, well, he wasn't really.
Technically separated. It doesn't come off in a verse.
I got involved with a married man.
So we settled down and, but I was ready to go to Europe and tour really heavily with Lowdown Time. So the one before Test Your Love, the Buffalo Clover record.
Uh-huh.
And then I find out that I'm pregnant and.
It's your husband's on the band though.
He was, yeah.
He was in Buffalo
playing
Clover
electric guitar.
Oh, okay,
and
okay.
That, yeah.
So but, you both find out you're pregnant.
Yeah, we both find out we're pregnant and, you know, we're happy. But I think at that point I had thought, I'm just going to have dogs and just be a musician. Because he had told me that he couldn't have kids. So we're together for 7 years,
that
not getting
line.
Pregnant. And
yeah.
Then all of a sudden, boom, pregnant with twins. And so it was just a really trying pregnancy. And I found out about 17, 18 weeks that one of my sons had a heart defect. He had hypoplastic left heart syndrome, and he had half a heart. Ugh. And so they told me that, and I was at Vanderbilt, a really great hospital in Tennessee. They were second best on doing this particular surgery that he needed. 90% chance he was going to survive, but he would probably have only lived to be 30 or 40.
Right.
And so that was a really heavy pill to swallow. And
before he's even out of
before
you?
Before he was even born. Yeah. So my depression like starts then.
Right.
And I'm already like a, like I said, kind of a manic depressive person anyway. But I have them, and doctor does the surgery and fucked it up, and we lost him. And then started the downward spiral. Yeah. But I, you know, here I have a perfectly healthy baby at home, and every day was, it was happy, but it was, there was just always a sadness there. I mean, we had two cribs, two car seats, two of everything.
Oh, you bought all.
So yeah, that got really heavy, and but you know, I was still being a good mother.
Yeah.
But you know, I would go out, and if I drank in a bad mood, it was just over. Bad.
Yeah.
And,
well, there's a normal sort of postpartum depression that happens.
Exactly.
But compounded by the absence of.
Yeah, it was just terrible. Yeah. And it just affected me so much. So.
So you're an angry drunk?
I would get sad. And then I was so depressed that I was thinking of checking myself into a place. And I kept saying it out loud. Yeah. And it was like nobody was really aware of how bad I was.
Right.
And like, I mean, thinking like suicidal thoughts.
Right, right, right.
So one night I went over to a friend's. She was a mother and a musician, and she also was a wine dealer. Mm-hmm. We get all loaded on like really expensive wine, and I'm playing drums and having fun. I'd started out kind of crying, but the drunker I got, that you know, the more I forgot about things. Right. And then the night starts getting really late, and I thought, I better get home. My husband's going to kick my ass. I really need to go. Call a cab. It was before like Uber and Lyft and all this. Cab doesn't come. Some time goes by, like drink some water, eat some crackers and cheese.
Sober up.
Think I'm good to go. And only a mile from my house, but I was driving. Mm-hmm. Very large Ford Explorer, and
hit. Oh, so you sobered up because the cab didn't come.
Yeah.
You're gonna drive.
I'm gonna drive. Yeah,
sure.
Definitely was sober enough.
Gonna George
drive.
Jones it.
Gonna do. Yeah, I wish I had a lawnmower. I would have got a lot less trouble. But I hit a telephone pole in front of two cops.
In front of them.
In front of two cops, and
good timing.
Yeah, and I was so close to my house.
That's
and,
the worst.
And then I was thinking like, I'm going to jail. Maybe I can outrun the fuckers. So I start speeding away, thinking I'll just pull in someone's driveway. Because they were parked. I was going pretty fast.
Right.
And
you were shit-faced.
And I was shit-faced. Yeah. And I was not thinking clearly.
Clearly, yeah.
And finally pull over because there's two cop cars and one's like side of me and one's behind me.
Oh, really? They're kind of pushing you?
Yeah.
They're making you pull
pouring
over.
Pouring down rain. They make me walk the line. Of course, I fail horribly. They take me to jail. And I was charged with like public property damage, fleeing the scene of an accident. A whole list of things. And went to court, ended up getting reckless endangerment, which is a misdemeanor and does not look very good.
Sure.
When you look up the definition, it's like you went out trying to hurt other people. And I was only trying to hurt myself.
Right.
So anyway,
now your husband's got to put up with this shit. He's home with the kid.
He gets a call in the middle of the night. He thinks I'm dead way that the cops called. And end up, you know, going to court. My lawyer's like, all right, you're going to have to go do a weekend, but it's a white collar prison. The people are going to be so nice. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be bad. Well, he lied to me because it was terrible.
Uh-huh.
And you know, he couldn't even bring in a book.
Prison was bad. Imagine.
Who would have thought? And the girl that was my roommate, she was all messed up on pills. She slept all day. She had beat her boyfriend up high on crack cocaine. And she had me actually mail a letter to him because he wasn't answering her phone calls. His name was Cash. So after that, I you know, just really did not want to
go. She sent you out with a letter?
Sent me out with a letter.
Right. Yeah. When you left. Oh,
she
you're getting
like,
out here.
Call me. Just gave me your phone number.
Right, right.
But it was so eye-opening. There's, you know, to see the, all the women in there and all the things they had been through. And actually really want to go do a tour of a woman's prison. Speaking of the Johnny Cash live in San Quentin.
Yeah.
But after I got out, I sobered up for a long time and got my shit together and started writing more. And then that was...
Being a better mom.
Being a better mom, yeah.
Better wife.
Yeah, trying at least.
Well, you must have married a real hero.
He's put up with a lot, more than you'll ever know.
And you guys are good?
Yeah, we're good. He was playing bass and for quite a while, and then things got incredibly busy, and I was on the road so much. We don't have a bus. We're still touring in like a Sprinter, so I can't. It's not an option, really, to bring my son along.
Right, how old is he now?
He's 6.
Oh.
Yeah, he's starting kindergarten this year. I'm going to be there for his first day of kindergarten, so that's good.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, he's great.
And what do you do? You just leveled off and got pulled it in, or you got real
leveled
sober?
I got sober for a while. Now I drink sometimes, but I never drink if I'm in a bad mood.
Okay. You don't feel compelled. You don't drink alcoholically necessarily.
I don't. That's good. I go on, and I'm working so much, I lose my voice if I'm drinking.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Do you smoke?
When I drink. So yeah, I'll go long amounts of time. I just smoke pot.
Yeah.
And find myself.
All right. But you're level and you're showing up for work.
I am. Yeah. Things have really.
And you're showing up really for the family around. Business.
Yeah.
So wait, where's the Winnebago part?
Well, the Winnebago.
After you get out of prison.
This was before. Yeah.
Oh damn.
Yeah.
That was another dream. The LA
that
dream.
That was the whole other dream we had. For a while, I was acted as my own manager. I created a man that, because people responded much better in emails.
So you invented a dude.
Hi, this is Margo. I want to book a show. Hello, this is John Sirota. I'm writing on behalf of Buffalo Clover. So we had this guy that was, he booked a tour across the United States started in Illinois, went to Nashville, and we went to North Carolina, played all the way across the U.S.
In a Winnebago. Yeah.
And I booked it all as a man.
And
as a fictitious man.
With your husband.
Yep, my husband. He was playing electric guitar. Yeah. I was playing acoustic. And then
and the band is
drummer
the,
and bass player.
The jazz drummer.
Jazz drummer, yeah.
In the Winnebago.
Yep, in the Winnebago. Living the dream. And yeah, that was a whole experience unto itself. But after we played our last show, we played in Los Angeles, and then we went up to like Hermosa Beach or something and played a show. And then right when we played the last show, the Winnebago, it was a 1986 Winnebago, quit going into third gear. So we drove all the way up the Pacific Coast Highway going 35 miles an hour with people just honking at us.
Yeah.
Trip on mushrooms again in the Redwood Forest for like a week.
Oh, that's nice.
Get all booby-eyed and feeling crazy. And then I thought that it was just destiny. Right, things weren't really taking off in Nashville. Winnebago breaks down on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Let's stay out here.
Oh, yeah. We'll live here.
Yeah.
That's where it stops.
Playing psychedelic music anyway. Sure. But my husband, he really wanted to go back to Tennessee, and his parents also really wanted us to go back. So we sold the Winnebago to these hippies that we met. Have you ever heard of the Rainbow Children?
Yeah.
Yeah. Stay away from
them. There's a documentary on them, I think.
Really? I need to check that out.
They're a cult.
Yeah, it's a very strange little... And we found them... I mean, we were just staying at trailer parks the whole tour. We didn't have to get any hotels or anything. You just pull up in the trailer park next to...
wherever.
Yeah, Bob and Helen or whatever.
Yeah.
And we pulled into this one. It was like this guy told us in the town where we could do free camping. And it was all the Rainbow Children. And... they were kind of terrifying that, you know, they wanted to trade like their Grateful Dead t-shirt for weed or, toilet paper or whatever you had on you. Yeah,
hippie barter.
Yeah. Smelled so bad. So the Winnebago is not going so well. So we sell it to these rainbow kids and for like $300. Uh-huh. And they were telling us that they would give us more money later. When we mailed them the title, because I hadn't even got the title yet, because we only had it for a month, and we drove it into the ground.
Yeah.
And so go back home, the U-Haul, maybe like a month later, my dad gets a call from the Reno Police Department, and they said that my Winnebago was abandoned on the side of the road. And I never saw it again.
That was it?
That was it.
What do you say, that it was stolen?
By Winnie Cooper.
Oh, yeah. That was the end of that story.
That was like,
Well, you could have ended up in the Rainbow Children. So
I mean, things really went the way they should have. I'm so glad we didn't stay there.
You could have been still there. Well, that's good. Well, that's interesting that, his parents were like, just come back.
You guys need to quit this music thing. And
oh, they were like that?
Get a normal life.
Yeah.
And, but I mean, they've helped support us. We're losers. Every now and then you got to get some help financially. And we'd burned all our money up on this Winnebago and this tour that really got us nowhere.
Did you open for anybody, or are you just doing clubs on your own?
I was just doing
And there was no real record, no one knew you.
No. And we made a documentary of the whole trip.
Where's that?
A little camcorder. It's called Maybe We'll Make It. Oh. And it was like Maybe We'll Make It.
Sure.
Yeah. A lot of metaphors there, but we did not make it then.
So then you just kind of dug in Nashville, and that's how you got, to the place you're at now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad that I stuck with it. The only reason that I wanted to go back was, like, in my mind, I didn't want to let that city kick my ass. I wanted to conquer it. When I first moved there, I wrote down all the venues I wanted to play on a sheet of paper, and I slowly checked them off. Start with the Dive Bar, Springwater. Okay, we're done.
Yeah.
The End. Yeah. Exit In, Five Spot, Third and Lindsley. Go down the list, and glad I went back.
When you'd streamlined the band and made it more of a country outfit, were you picking up a following? Was that starting to happen in town?
Yeah, things were going well for a while. I played this small club called The Basement.
Yeah.
And this guy from Rolling Stone was there and absolutely floored by the performance. This was probably about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Right around the time that the jail stuff was happening, and I hadn't written the jail song yet, written Hands of Time, but had like Hurtin' on the Bottle and like all the, Since You Put Me Down, those tunes. Guy from Rolling Stone comes up and says, "Where's your record? I want to review it. Where the hell did you come from?" And I said, "I don't have a record. Hang on really quickly." And then I wrote this insane letter, sent it out to all these producers and labels. "I'm about to make the best country record you've ever heard. Give me money."
Put your name on that one?
Yeah.
Margo Price.
Nobody wrote me back.
Blew it out there?
I just threw it out there. Like, maybe someone would help.
After you talked to the Rolling Stone guy.
Yeah, because I thought, and I would tell people.
He's on to something.
Yeah, I'm like, Rolling Stone did this feature on me. They shared my little video I did, and we got a good thing. There's a good buzz going, but nobody would bite on it. So about a year goes by, and my husband just up and decides to sell the car. He's like, "We're making this record. And that's the end of it." And I
tried to talk him out of it.
I said, don't sell the car. He went down, he sold the car.
Uh-huh.
It was a little Mini Cooper. And it had been kind of gifted to us from his grandmother whatever. And I didn't really feel right about driving it around anyway because I didn't earn it.
Right.
And so sold the car. And
how are you getting around Nashville?
Well, we had another car, which we still have one car. We just share it now.
Mm-hmm.
And Nashville's not a very friendly city if you don't have a car.
Right.
You can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take the bus. There's no subway. There's not even bike lanes. So.
Yeah.
So we fight over the car, and but we go into Sun Studio and make a record in 3 days.
What, you just paid the cost of the studio?
Yeah, just
who'd you bring in? Who produced it? You guys?
Well, my friend Alex Munoz, he's from Spain, and he kept saying, "I want to come along and produce this record." And I said, "Man, we just don't have the budget. We're just very small budget." And he told my husband on the side, he said, "I'm going to come do it. I'll do it for free. You guys can worry about paying me later."
Yeah.
I said, "Alex, you might not ever get paid."
Yeah.
But he came along anyway. I paid all my musicians, all the dudes in my band, and we recorded live to Radar, which is like this weird analog thing, and happened real fast, and I was so happy with the way it came out.
This record's all live?
Yeah.
No shit.
I went back and redid some of the vocals, but all the playing is all live.
It must be, because there is something really whole sounding to it.
And This Town Gets Around, that's a live vocal. It's really has that kind of Johnny Cash like slap back. Everything's in the same room. So get done with it. I'm so happy with how it came out.
So you self-produce that thing?
Yeah, yeah. And Alex Munoz and Matt Ross Spang, they both kind of help and engineer and produce it for very little.
Were you friends with like Cobb and Sturgill and all those cats at that time?
I had known Sturgill, but had never met Dave, and I don't think he had any interest in really working with me. He had a lot of things going on at the time. So
there wasn't really a unified kind of little new country community down there.
No, I mean, I think everybody wants to think East Nashville is so...
Yeah.
Everybody loves each other and everyone's collaborating. And there is a lot of that, but there's also a very competitive, business-minded, get out of my fucking way.
Right.
Or I'll step on your head to get to the top.
So now you've got this analog tape.
Yeah, got it. And I'm floored. I think it turned out great.
Yeah.
And I start sending it to... big labels, small labels, Americana labels.
Yourself.
Indie labels, yeah.
But like Bloodshot and like who?
Totally, totally, totally. You know.
Merge.
New West. You know, even was talking to Sony a little bit. They had me come in, play for them. But nobody was biting. And the one person that was biting, they wanted me to take off the fiddle and take off, change the bass and make it more a soul record. And so I was getting.
They still heard that in there somehow.
Yeah, yeah. They wanted, you know, because I think it was in, you know, recorded in Memphis that they thought we could just totally flip this and make it all soul or something. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so many rejections that.
But it's interesting that they heard that in this record because like that you did make a soul record and it was in you.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't hear it in the record necessarily.
Yeah, yeah. The pedal steel and I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, it.
But they were like, "There's a soul record in here."
Yeah, this one. Yeah, this one label. They offered me more money than I'd ever seen at the time, and I thought about it, but then I just couldn't change it.
Yeah, yeah, and, good.
So there was a lot of rejections. I think I'm actually going to get my rejection letters framed.
Yeah,
I think that'll be a good look on my wall. You know, all the no's and the
mount them together like in, like a large piece.
Yeah,
yeah,
and then finally, Third Man comes along and.
Jack specifically or his guy?
I heard, you know, Jack likes what you're doing. He wants to hear the record.
Uh-huh.
So I meet his, the other two Third Men, Ben Swank, Ben Blackwell. They come out to show and they love it. They love the record.
Can't say how he wouldn't.
Yeah, they didn't want to change anything and it was insane. And so for a few months, you know, we were kind of just talking and figuring things out. And
yeah.
I remember my pedal steel player, once we knew that it was going to happen, that they were actually going to sign us.
Yeah.
And not just like put out a single or something, like the whole record. My pedal steel player, he said, going to be a lot of toilets flushing in Nashville the day they find out. You're signing the Third Man. And it's always nice now when I see some of these folks, hey, how are you doing? Good to see you, you know?
Yeah.
And it turned out way better than, you know, had I signed with anybody else.
Right, because like he's an artist's producer and label.
Yeah. It still feels like a dream. I don't know how things have gone so well.
Just what are you talking about?
Waiting for them to go wrong.
You sounds like you paid some dues.
I know. Well, you know all about that too.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not like I'm kind of looking behind my back.
No, I know.
When's the evil thing going to bite me again and I'll slip back into the hole of loserdom?
Well, the good thing about evil things biting you when you're a country singer is that's your next record.
Exactly. If they didn't bite me. Now it's like the internet trolls, you know, I got to.
The worst.
But it like feeds the fire.
You get trolls?
Get some trolls and it's never talking about my music. It's never, you suck. I hate your voice. You can't write a song. It's always, she's not pretty enough, or, you know,
she needs
a nose job. With women, it's always a comment on the looks. I don't understand. She's wearing too much makeup. She's not wearing enough makeup. She's dressed like a slut. She's dressed like a prude.
Don't read them.
It's fucking ridiculous. On
Twitter or what?
Yeah, Twitter's probably the worst.
Yeah, what is it? So they see you on TV and that's when it happens?
Yeah, yeah, or like, you know, somebody, one of the late night shows put up like a photo of me and then it's just...
Yeah, don't fucking do that.
Yeah, I can't read the comments anymore. No. It ruins my happiness.
And for people that are like, sort of like, you know, kind of, you know, sensitive, like myself or whatever.
I am sensitive.
Well, also like, you know, you want to read the good shit, but then it's just this speedball of garbage.
It ruins it for people writing good shit.
Oh, yeah,
I don't even open my messages anymore.
Well, you can't, like, people, well, like me, I don't know you specifically, but you kind of blow through the good shit.
Yeah.
And then when the bad shit hits, you're like, wait, what the fuck?
Yeah. And then it fuels you up.
And then the people writing good shit hate you for that shit. They're like, what about we say nice things? Like, yeah. But what about this fucking idiot?
Yeah, exactly. I love how you spoke up for Amy Schumer, too. That was really nice.
Oh, but those are all the same. She's, those dudes are
amazing.
The same.
And it's the same thing. It's like, what do you...
They do. It's all this. It's all, you know, these fucking babies with women.
Yeah.
It's just like, shut up.
Sitting at home and, you know, living at their parents' house, right? What can I say about her?
Yeah. Or even worse, not living at their parents' house and sitting at home playing video games. You know, like it's just something that exists now. And
it
comes and goes. So wait, so did you meet Jack? I mean, do you have a relationship with him?
Yeah.
He's a nice guy. I went down there.
So nice. Yeah. Have you done the Third Man tour? And
I interviewed him down there years ago.
Yeah.
We talked about blues and stuff. And, you know, I you know,
You guys have the same the speaker set up for the...
For the Macintosh?
Yeah.
Well, he, like, when I saw his, I'm like, I got to get it. And then when I saw how much
and
it
then
was,
the
it's a fucking nightmare. But, I, like, but he's got great. More than I do, you know, and he's I think, a different thing. But I ended up getting it. So what is your deal with them? How many records?
I got one more with them. And then we'll
Are you going to let him produce it?
I don't know yet. I've been just kind of starting the conversation about where I'm going to do it and who's going to produce and all that. I've got 30 songs.
You do?
Maybe more. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And I really want to do something big. I hate thinking about just putting out like 10 songs or something because...
Well, don't burn them all.
Yeah. I mean...
It's too much.
Got to save them for when the creative juice dries up, maybe. But
no, but like a tight record's good, though, man.
Yeah,
I mean, like sometimes, like it's like, well, Sturgill's kind of aware of it too. That there's nothing wrong with actually thinking in terms of a record and not thinking in terms of like just putting songs on there, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think they are good songs. I don't want to, you know, just put shit on there. But I feel like when you first write a song, it will never mean as much to you in 5 years as the moment when you wrote it,
right?
So that's
so you don't
want
to hold on
my
to
thought, but
right.
I could just, you know, record them and then hold on to them for later.
I wasn't being, you do what you got to do. Either way, I'll listen to all the songs.
Okay. Well, I'm sending you 2 Buffalo Clover vinyls.
So. I'm going to make note of that. I love this record and I'm glad
we
talked.
I love you. Like I said, we listen to you on the road and when we get real burnt out of just listening to albums.
Yeah.
It makes the time go by.
Everyone just listening to
Everybody
me
listens, yeah. 9 people in there. Just everybody's cracking up. And
do people
great.
Go like, ah, Maren, what'd you ask that
no,
for?
No, no.
What are you doing?
It was great. But the Neil Young one was amazing
that
to
was
listen
so
to.
Nervous, dude.
I can't imagine.
Because he was hard for about 10 or 15 minutes. Like,
yeah,
it was
you
like,
warm him up. Neil's not even warm him up.
Right. It's not even warm him up. It's like... There's just some, he doesn't give a fuck.
Right.
And he doesn't, you know.
He doesn't need to.
And he doesn't really like to do interviews, but he wanted to Pono to get out there. And,
yeah.
And like he clearly did not want to talk about anything that you know, had anything.
You wanted to ask, yeah.
Well, no, I didn't know where to start. You know, I'm starting with gear and he's like, yeah, I think I got, like he's dismissing.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm like, I got this amp, it's like yours. He's like, oh, yeah, it looks, I think I got one like that. I'm like, oh, he's not going to. Not going to bite on equipment.
What are we going to talk about?
Well, I think the reason people liked it was he seemed to loosen up and have a good time.
Oh, he totally did. And I felt like he was kind of interviewing you. Like, you know, he like flipped it around.
Yeah.
The lozenges and the math on those. I was at doing a thing with KCRW and I saw outside the studio we were at, there was a sign that said reserved for Shaky. And I found out he was there, and I wanted to meet him so bad. I'm a massive Neil Young freak, and I called Third Man. Hey, you guys did that thing with him. Can you get me to meet him?
Hasn't happened yet?
I didn't get to meet him. He like left for lunch, and then something happened. He got pissed off at somebody, didn't come back for the day. He said, Neil's not in a good mood today. But I can understand that. I got a lot of...
Have you been able to meet, like, as I talked to Sturgill about that, you know, about his heroes or people he respected. Have you been able to meet any of the people? Like, who are your gals and guys?
Well, I mean, I love Bob Dylan. Speaking of Bobbies.
Another hard guy to meet.
Yeah, I'm never going to meet him probably, but I love Bob Dylan. Have everything he's ever done. Of course, I love Loretta. I'm dying to meet her. Still haven't got to yet. Love Dolly Parton. Love
Dolly
Jesse
Parton's
Coulter.
Great. Yeah,
Waylon's wife.
Yeah.
And I did, the coolest person I've got to meet and actually got to sing with was, I got to sing with Kris Kristofferson.
You did?
And I met him twice and we've got to hang out. And so that's been the highlight for me. I got off stage, I sang, and Patti Smith was stuck in traffic. She was supposed to come sing with him at Newport.
Yeah.
And I got this text message that just said, Patti Smith stuck in traffic. Do you want to come sing me and Bobby McGee with Kris Kristofferson? And I was in the middle of an interview with Rolling Stone and I just was like, I got to leave. I ran over there and got on stage with him and it was the coolest thing ever. He like leaned over in my ear and he just said, you sound beautiful on stage. I get off. I'm like, it's the best natural high I'd ever had. Like,
oh, that's amazing. Yeah. When did that happen?
That happened at Newport just like a week and a half.
Ago. Really?
Yeah, I'll send you a little video of it.
And how's he?
He's good. He's you know, he's dealing with Lyme disease. He
really?
Was misdiagnosed. Uh-huh. They thought that he had Alzheimer's, uh-huh. and he got it probably from what his wife thinks is crawling around on a floor during, like, the floor of a forest. Picked up a tick during a movie.
Oh.
And just never got diagnosed.
Oh wow.
So he's having a lot of memory issues.
Okay.
But he can still remember his songs and remember how to play them. And it's like the Glenn Campbell thing.
Yeah.
It's just so cool to see.
He's heavy, man. He's heavy presence.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. So you want to play a song? Can
sure,
you?
Sure, sure.
All right. Hold on. I'm going to stop this and we'll set up.
I'm going to do this song that is the B-side for a 7-inch we did at Third Man. It's called Desperate and Depressed. I'm pissed off at the number of people that I meet who go to shake my hand with a viper up their sleeve. It frees me out in the winter, burn me up all summer, try to take my money when I'm desperate and depressed. Ain't it a mess? I played for free and paid for the miles on my tell, cause the worry keeps me up. It almost drives me crazy thinking about my baby and how he's gonna love me if I'm desperate and depressed. Can't get no rest. Mom never told me things would be this way. Dad tried to warn me that there'd be hell to pay. But if I stuck here making someone else's dime. I busked in Sarasota, made $27. I wept for Richard Manuel, thinking I might have his luck. But you talk behind my back. Well, don't stab me in the front, but don't think you can hurt me, cause I'm desperate and depressed. Self-medication, but none of that can cure you when you're desperate and depressed. What else is left? Mom never told me things would be this way. Dad tried to warn me that there'd be hell to pay. But if I can't find the money, then I can't buy the life. Oh, 10% and nothing ain't a dime. So don't you try to sell me back what's mine. I'll be desperate and depressed until I die.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That sounded good.
That was fun.
Nice meeting you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
How great is she? Seriously. I'm not just, you know, I don't have her up on a pedestal. I don't have a crush on her. I just think she's great. All right, have a little crush on her. go to WTFpod.com and check those tour dates. Carnegie's almost done. Almost sold out. Might be. I got to check. Got Chicago coming up, Nashville, Tallahassee, dates in the spring, in Connecticut, and upstate New York. And just go to the website. Get the poster. Do what you got to do. Boomer lives!